Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The U.S. prison population has been shrinking in recent years to almost 1.6 million, but it's still the busiest prison system in the world, the result of a trend four decades long, starting with the war on drugs in the late 1970s, which brought with it a population increase every year between 1978 and 2009. In fact, five times as many prisoners are now supported by the system as in 1978. In August, Attorney General Eric Holder announced the Justice Department would end its policy of mandatory minimum sentencing for certain low-level, nonviolent offenders. And last month, Senators Patrick Leahy of Vermont and Rand Paul of Kentucky introduced a bill that would give judges more discretion in sentencing. Joining us now to talk about how we got to this overcrowded state of prison affairs and the role of mandatory minimum sentencing in that state of affairs is sentencing expert and OSU law professor Douglas Berman. Welcome to the show, Doug.
Thank you very much, Ann. Glad to be here.
So what has spurred Congress over the years to establish these mandatory minimums? What were the initial goals?
Well, there was a variety of goals that led to a variety of mandatory minimums, probably principally the entire move for what's often called determinate sentencing reform was a fear that judges were varying too much in the sentences they were giving to different offenders. And actually, often it was more progressive members of Congress who were concerned that minority defendants or those who weren't upper-middle-class, white-collar defendants were getting longer sentences, while more serious defendants, if they could make a good story to the judge and looked more like the judge, would get more lenient sentences. And so there's been a broader move to bring a little bit more law to sentencing. And that over time transformed into a tough-on-sentencing kind of concern. And there were a variety of competing realities that drove that. One were rising crime rates. Another was, and this is, you mentioned at the outset, the war on drugs, a heightened sense that we needed to get tougher on drug offending, and in particular to bring uniquely harsh sentences to serious drug dealers. Often we talk about kingpins and the like, and the sense that really drove Congress, and this was very much in the 80s, a bipartisan reform, both sides saying we need to bring not just harsher sentencing, but mandated harsher sentencing to all serious drug offenders. And that led to what are the kinds of sentences that Attorney General Holder was now talking about, you know, 20, 30 years later as being too harsh, because the way those laws were drawn, though they tried to get after kingpins, the biggest problem was they focused on the quantity of the drugs involved. And that proved over time not to be a particularly good metric for who is a more or less serious offender.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Doug Berman. He's a professor at OSU's Moritz College of Law. We're talking about mandatory minimum sentencing and reforms that are afoot now at the federal level. Of course, there's mandatory minimum sentencing at the state level as well. That's different.
That's right. And one of the challenges in talking about mandatory minimums is there's generally among academics and policy advocates a strong push against mandatory minimums. Usually the focus, though, is on the federal system, where I think everybody agrees, with maybe a few exceptions, that the mandatory minimums are especially harsh and problematically especially focused on lower-level offenders, especially for drug crimes, whereas in state systems, when there are mandatory minimums, they're much more likely to be focused on repeat offenders and also on more violent offenders. And so it's important when you talk about these issues to keep in mind different jurisdictions use mandatory minimums in different ways, and some of the criticisms may apply more or less depending on how a state system uses it.
Right. Not to be confused, I covered the legislature during the early 90s when the three strikes and you're out laws were going through, much harsher, but it had to do with weapons violations and so forth. And
that's exactly right. In fact, one of the interesting stories here is California, just in this last election cycle, also repealed some of their mandatory minimums in three strike settings, but only for nonviolent offenders when the third strike's nonviolent. And so one of the big things that's going on at the federal level, at state levels as well, is to try to do a better job of who these mandatory minimums would apply to, and particularly to try to define and differentiate violent versus nonviolent offenders.
What do we know about the connection between prison, the prison population, which in most places is overcrowded, and mandatory minimums. Is it a correlation or is it a causation?
There's probably a little bit of both, okay. Right? And so we can definitely, and one of the many reasons California reformed its three strikes laws is largely because of the costs and the increase in prison populations that was driving that. Though there's a lot of nuance, and this is, as an academic, I get focused on all those details about whether or not it's that prosecutors are using these mandatory minimums more to bring in more low-level offenders and get them sent to prison for longer periods of time, or if it's just that more people are pleading guilty, more people are cutting deals in a variety of ways. And so it's a combination of forces, but we see both causation and correlation. And because of that, that's one of the real moves that's driving efforts to reduce reliance on mandatory minimums, prisons getting overcrowded, the economic costs of these long prison terms that are mandated, especially when judges say, I don't think there's a good public safety reason to have these long sentences for particular low-level offenders. That's all combining to move this modern reform effort.
Yeah, we'll be hearing from the National District Attorneys Association, which opposes the reforms as they stand, the ones introduced by Senators Rand Paul and Patrick Leahy at the federal level. And also we'll be hearing from a federal judge who supports reforms, maybe more incrementally, but be that as it may, they support it. What do we know about the racial makeup of the prison system and its relationship to mandatory minimums?
Well, there's absolutely no doubt that we've seen over the last 30 years, as we've had an increase in the overall prison population, that it's disproportionately minority offenders, both African-Americans and Hispanic offenders, that are flooding the prisons even more. And again, this is a story that has some variation at the state level versus the federal level. But we see across the board that it is skewed towards minority populations disproportionately, and the census. And again, this gets back to the war on drugs, that those individuals, particularly the low-level offenders, most likely to get caught up in street-level dealing and be subject to long prison terms, even for less serious offenses, those have been shown to be very disproportionately minority offenders. And that's one of the reasons that we've seen this drive for reform. Racial justice communities are emphasizing, look, this is not a law that was intended to create equality, achieving that. In fact, we're seeing inequality sort of built into the system based on enforcement patterns.
Yeah, and the numbers tell the story, just to let people know. Whites make up almost 80% of the U.S. population, but just over a third of the prison population. Blacks make up 13% of the U.S. population overall, but almost three times that in the state prison population. I mentioned the federal legislation earlier, but Congress in 1994 enacted a safety valve provision that was supposed to provide relief from mandatory minimums for certain nonviolent first-time drug offenders. How did that work?
It's actually worked very well. In fact, I think because it's worked so well, the sense is that safety valve ought to be expanded. And so it's not surprising that the bill you mentioned by Rand Paul and Senator Leahy is called the Justice Safety Valve Act. And basically, we saw a round of reform where in the late 80s, early 90s, there was broad expression of concern that these mandatory minimums were applying too severely and that low-level offenders would get caught up in them and be sentenced to 5 or 10 years, which tends to be the metric at the federal level, even for just a small drug dealing offense. And Congress responded to that concern by passing this Safety Valve Act. And in fact, many low-level offenders have gotten the benefit of it. The problem is, and this is what's leading the next wave of reform, if you have even one very minor criminal history from years earlier, even if it was maybe a DUI or something that we wouldn't think is that serious a prior offense, and certainly it's sufficient if it was also a nonviolent offense, you become ineligible for this safety valve. In addition, you not only have to plead guilty, but you have to plead guilty essentially on the terms that the government has demanded. And so another concern that particularly I think Rand Paul has been emphasizing is the unfairness of having the prosecutor essentially determine whether or not you're going to be eligible for the safety valve or eligible for credit for cooperating.
Because the prosecutor has a point of view, whereas the judge is the one that's supposed to be without that.
That's exactly right. And that's what the bill, this Justice Safety Valve Act, is trying to achieve, is giving judges authority to go below the mandatory minimum as long as they provide reasons on the record for why they think sentence below the mandatory minimum is justified under the circumstances.
When we're talking about mandatory minimums at the federal level, and again, that's what this hour is about, is the mandatory minimums at the federal level. Are they always felonies?
Yes, they are always felonies. Right. And again, that's one of the, I think, reasons people are inclined to say we shouldn't worry too much about these minimums being applied too broadly. They're not only always felonies, but they involve a certain quantity of drugs or use of a gun. One of the other notable mandatory minimums involves, even if you're involved in a drug deal and there's a gun in your house, that you could be doing the deal in the basement and the gun can be up in the attic for, you know, self-defense purposes, that can trigger a mandatory minimum. And so we're talking about only at the federal level, the prosecutors will generally say, look, it's only for serious crimes. And in fact, prosecutors have discretion not to charge some of those mandatory minimums if they think it would be inappropriate in a specific case. And that's why Attorney General Holder, I think, in some sense, is trying to get ahead of some of the congressional reforms. I think he thinks if I, as Attorney General, provide instructions to my prosecutors not to use these mandatory minimums too broadly, maybe that will keep Congress from getting rid of them altogether.
Yeah, but he's not going to be Attorney General forever.
That is certainly true, although that's itself why I think members of Congress are inclined to say that's a nice move, but that's insufficient to make the kind of long-term reforms we think are needed.
And he is doing it immediately, and he's upped the ante by expanding that new policy to pending cases.
That's exactly right. And one of the things that gets back to what you were talking about with the federal safety valve reform that was done by statute back in the 90s, the new guidance that Attorney General Holder gave to his line prosecutors focused on this idea that we wouldn't charge a mandatory minimum even if the person had a little bit of criminal history, as long as it wasn't a serious criminal history. And that really has been the sticking point for a lot of these sympathetic cases, where you have somebody who maybe, you know, 20 years earlier had some low-level drug-related offenses, nothing all that serious, and then get mixed up in a low-level drug-dealing thing 20 years later, and they're ineligible for the safety valve, even though there's been no violence, even though a judge thinks 5 or 10 years is far too long under the circumstances. Those are all considerations that the Attorney General says can now be thought through by prosecutors in deciding whether to charge a mandatory minimum.
There is the exception of substantial assistance, which can lower mandatory minimums for some drug offenders. Those have had some of the worst unintended consequences.
I think that's exactly right. Well, so one of the other reasons why prosecutors tend not to favor these kinds of reforms is they've discovered that the threat of mandatory minimums provides an incredible bit of leverage in plea negotiations to get drug offenders facing these minimums to cooperate and to essentially rat out others. And the thought was, and I think it's a thought that still makes sense, hey, you get a low-level offender, they're subject to a 5 or 10 year sentence unless they tell you who their middleman was or who the kingpin was. And the hope was, through cooperation credit, we both incentivize the low-level offenders to rat out the folks they got the drugs from, and that makes it easier and more effective for law enforcement to go after the real kingpins. The problem is, and this is the unintended consequences, the folks who usually have the most information are the kingpins. They're the ones who can go to the prosecutors and say, hey, I can tell you about 10 other kingpins. And disproportionately, it's been the higher level offenders who get the benefit of cooperation. The low level guys often can't provide information, or, and this is the key, it's written, you not only have to provide assistance, you have to provide substantial assistance. So if the low-level mule doesn't know that much about the whole drug operation, he doesn't have the information necessary to get the benefit of this cooperation credit.
He'll still get
the mandatory minimum. And those, again, are some of the more extreme cases that cause concern for advocates.
We've had an overcrowding problem in prisons for a while, and I would direct listeners, you know, to go to any, you know, just Google it and look at the graphs. It's incredible how the population has increased since the mandatory minimums went into effect. But that's been going on for 4 decades now. Why is this legislation being introduced now, all things being equal? I mean, what's the push now? Is it just economics?
It's mostly economics. I think it also combines effectively with a significant and continued success with crime rates. When crime was high, and this is itself sort of the one-way ratchet that led to our increased prison populations, crime's high, we enact new sentencing laws, try to get tougher. Crime stays high. The instinct isn't, oh, those tough laws didn't work. the instinct is we need to get tougher and tougher and tougher. And then as crime goes down, there's an inclination to say, see, all that toughness worked. Let's not back away. And it's only really now, particularly at the state level, but also at the federal level, when the bills are coming due, that we realize, well, maybe this is helping. And there's a lot of debate in the research about how much imprisonment reduces crime rates. But even if it is helping, is this really the most cost-effective way, particularly for these low-level nonviolent offenders? Put the justice issues aside, and that's what advocates have been complaining about for a long time. It's just unjust and improper to put somebody away for so long when they're a low-level offender. But the economics become extraordinary, and I think we're at a time when not only we're rethinking mandatory minimums, we're rethinking the entire war on drugs, we're rethinking whether long periods of incarceration, whatever else they might achieve, are the most cost-effective ways to achieve reduced crime rates. And so that's, again, where we've finally gotten to a point where the short-term political benefits of being tough have kind of waned, and the long-term costs of incarcerating people for very long periods of time when there's no obvious public safety benefit from doing so have now coalesced. And I think a big part of this has been the right's willingness, which had always been very strong on this tough-on-crime move, to be some of the leading voices saying this is just a game, maybe not worth the cost.
We're talking about mandatory minimum sentencing, how there's a push at the federal level to change the policies and change the laws in that regard. Coming up, we're going to hear from a district attorney from the state of California. He is represents a national organization of district attorneys that support mandatory minimum sentencing, and he's going to tell us why. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A bill has been introduced in the U.S. Senate that would give judges more discretion in sentencing, basically doing away with mandatory minimum sentencing policies that have been around for decades. The National District Attorneys Association has said it opposes the measure. Joining us now to talk about that position is the vice president of the National District Attorneys Association, District Attorney Mike Ramos of San Bernardino County in California. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. Good morning.
How does mandatory minimum sentencing that was established decades ago help you do your job today?
Yeah, well, you know, let me first start out by saying I'm also the chair of the Corrections and Reentry Committee for the National District Attorneys Association, and I've been talking about this for 2 years now. I don't know if you know this, but in our state, Governor Brown and his prison reform and what we call realignment has changed how we are now housing your lower-level felons locally. And we're having some issues and problems. But back to your question about the mandatory minimums, I think your first guest was talking about it. But if you think about the history and what occurred in, you know, the 60s and the 70s and the explosion of the crime rate back then, you know, we decided as a nation, as states, as citizens, that we have to do something about this. And we need to get tougher laws, tougher sentencing to hold these people responsible. And I don't think there's an argument from anybody that, you know, getting tougher on the laws and sentencing and mandatory minimums, that the crime rate has reduced. It has in California with the law that we had called three strikes. And if you look across the country and states, violent crime has reduced up to 50% in some states. So it's working.
How do you know it's working? How do you know that it's causative versus correlative? In other words, it just happens to be dropping at now. And it's only been happening in about the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, you know, well, you know, we use the term in our profession, incapacitation. Look, these people that are put in prison, they're not out on the streets committing crimes. And you know, it's a myth that we have a bunch of lower-level, nonviolent, non-serious felons in prison. We, as district attorneys, use our discretion, and I will say this, that in my conversations in our national association, just like we do in my office, We work with these individuals, especially those that are addicted to drugs. We try and get them rehabilitation. We start with a probation. We start with maybe two terms of probation, local jail time, trying to do everything we can to change this person's life with rehabilitation. That doesn't work. We finally then owe it to the citizens of our districts, our victims, that we need to house these people to protect them from further crime. So I think when you look at the numbers and the crime reduction, I mean, I think it speaks for itself.
How can, you know, I'm going to be having a federal judge from Grand Rapids, Michigan on coming up in the next segment who disagrees with you, okay? And
sure.
I'm wondering, everybody is on the same side.
Right.
But everybody's not on the same page. Why
right.
the dissonance? Why the difference between district attorneys and judges as a rule, not uniformly, yeah. but as a rule
sure.
on this issue?
Sure.
What do you make of that?
Well, I think I can understand judges' position. When a case comes before a judge and their hands are tied with the impact of mandatory minimums,
mm-hmm.
I can imagine they feel frustrated. But at the same time, if we do away with the mandatory minimums, I think we're going to have sentencing across the country that's going to be tossed up, and it's just going to end up a mess because you're going to have so many discretionary rulings. You're going to have sentencing of these criminals that's going to be at sometimes outrageous.
Which is something that they tried to change with the uniformity back in the 70s.
Sure, sure. I mean, one example is the recent case in Montana, the ex-teacher who raped a 14-year-old student who later killed herself, and he was given 30 days in jail. And, you know, the community was outraged, and they're going back and appealing that sentence. And that's a perfect example of what we need to do with the mandatory minimums. I mean, you've got these kinds of cases that are all over the country, and I truly believe that prosecutors, whether it's local district attorneys or the U.S. Attorney's Office, use their discretion prior to charging these cases. And it's incumbent upon us to determine just what the sentencing should be.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Also with us, Doug Berman, professor at OSU Moritz College of Law. Doug?
Well, I would say the other guest just perfectly captured the fundamental question here is who should be principally in charge of deciding what the sentence should be. And I think one of the, in my view, justified complaints about mandatory minimums is the prosecutors end up functionally deciding what the sentence will be. And I particularly like hearing the discussion of reentry and efforts to do alternatives to incarceration that prosecutors are focused on. I think that's one of the many reasons I'm so proud of the work that prosecutors at the state level and at the federal level do. But at the end of the day, I think we all should believe that sentencing is fundamentally a judicial function. And because that's a judge is independent, can hear from both sides, and among other things, has to make their decision about sentencing on the record, transparent, discussed. And I think that Montana case is a very good example, but ultimately an example of where prosecutors will often not use their discretion well. And yet when that leads to a judge with a certain sentencing outcome, the judge is who gets criticized, not the prosecutors. One of the reasons that Montana case even played out the way it did was how the prosecutors decided, I think, in my view, honestly, to take a kid glove approach to that case. And so it's very well to hear prosecutors say, we exercise our discretion well. What really goes on is their discretion's hidden.
Judges, though, can buck the mandatory minimum, can't they? They can decide to sentence differently. It's just that it's up for appeal at that point.
Well,
it's a cause of appeal.
And critically, and this is often the source of much controversy, if they're trying to buck it on grounds that aren't well-established in precedent, they will get reversed. And so judges will often, and this is why you often hear district judges, trial judges, sentencing judges complaining about mandatory minimums the most, they very much feel their hands are tied. And in fact, under applicable law, their hands are tied. And that's where they're saying, look, we know the offender. We've heard both sides. And we're put in this position to judge. And when our hands are tied, we can't judge. We can't judge fairly. And that's ultimately why I support this bill by Paul and Leahy. All they're trying to do is give judges that much more authority to untie their hands, but only if they explain why on the record, and that itself can be subject to appeal, as you mentioned.
District Attorney Ramos, what do you make of the Leahy-Rand bill pending?
Yeah, you know, here's my thoughts on that. Look, if there is a mandatory minimum that people are having heartburn over because they think it's too much time regarding whether it's a drug case or whatever the case may be, well, then lower that minimum. If you want to give a judge a discretion, have the mandatory minimum, have a middle, and have an aggravated term. That's what we do in the state of California. We have a mitigated term, midterm, and aggravated term. And then you can have some discretion with a judge. But the minute you get rid of that mandatory minimum, I guarantee you, the minute you get rid of that, crime rate is going to increase. These crooks, they talk to each other. They know what they're going to get. They know what the minimums are. I mean, it's a negotiation tool for prosecutors as well. It's a law enforcement tool. They understand what they're facing as far as a sentence goes when they get to this point in the criminal system. You take that away, then we're going to clog our courts, we're going to have more issues, and I think really you're going to take a tool away from law enforcement, which was discussed a little bit earlier on your show as well.
Yeah.
There's so many factors that go into this.
Yeah, we talked earlier about the substantial assistance, the policy whereby certain offenders can avoid mandatory minimums if they have provide information about the organization. And talk about how important that is, your work, and respond to what Doug Berman said, that of the unintended consequence of so many low-level people going, not being able to take advantage of that because they don't have the information. And then the drug kingpins who know everybody can take advantage of it.
Yeah, and I will tell you, I disagree with that. I think the people that, whether it's the U.S. Attorney's Office or my office, that are working with these folks, with law enforcement to assist them to go after the kingpins, the people that are top in the drug world. Now we have the organized gangs in prison that are running these lower street-level individuals, and they have ties and they have the information that is a great resource to us. We're finding more and more of that. So the cases that we're putting together with these folks that we're using with the plea negotiation is actually helping. It's helping us put the worst of the worst away. And there's been a big takedown by the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office in coordination with local DAs in our jurisdictions in Los Angeles County where it is working. So I disagree with that these lower-level felons don't have the information necessary. It's quite the opposite.
We have an email from Hal. He writes, isn't abolition of the death penalty expanding sentences for life without parole, which will also chronically raise prison populations in years to come? And, of course, we have not abolished the death penalty in the state of Ohio, but it's being imposed less and less. It's being asked for by prosecutors less and less, which means that there then is these longer life sentences.
Yeah, well, that's an attack that's being, we're seeing that across the nation. Mm-hmm. We just survived that in the state of California, an initiative to go after our death penalty. And people are talking about, well, then what's it going to do to the prison population with the lifer units, parole, and those issues that you talked about. But I will tell you right now that we, and I'll go back to this, we as prosecutors use our discretion. And that's one of the biggest decisions we make is taking somebody's life, a death penalty case. And we take all those factors into consideration. I talked about it. But the big thing that everybody's forgetting in this conversation are victims. What about the victims? I mean, what is the cost? We're talking about cost, and this is economic driven. What is the cost to have a safe society? What do we tell a mom and dad whose daughter or son was murdered? Oh, this costs too much, so we can't keep this person in prison. I mean, we keep forgetting that's the big part of all of this conversation.
But a lot of these citizens. About a lot of these mandatory minimums, though, were imposed back in the 70s and so forth when it was the war on drugs, fueled in large part by the war on drugs. There a lot of them are targeted at drug offenders, and it's debatable what a victim is in a drug deal. Of course, if someone's killed or hurt in the process of a drug deal, or someone's a hapless victim that happens to be walking by during a drug fight, that's a different story. But as far as direct victimization, there's a debate about that. But so are we kind of talking about two different levels here or two different issues in a way?
I would disagree. You talk to a mom and dad whose child got addicted to drugs in middle school or high school because drug dealers that are dealing drugs in their neighborhoods, there are true victims. And those are the same lower-level felons that we're trying to rehabilitate and help through our reentry programs and all the programs we're trying to put together. So there are true victims, and that's why minimum sentencing, mandatory minimums, work.
And I chime in. I think what your questions, Anne, and the responses sort of highlight is one of the enduring challenges as we work through these issues is this differentiation between violent and nonviolent crimes, and particularly as it relates to the drug war, because many prosecutors say, and with the experience and the evidence in front of them, drug crimes are violent. And their assertion is, don't tell us stories about nonviolent drug dealers. Every one of the folks who are peddling poison in a community are doing violence to that community. The problem, of course, is you see the extreme cases, and actually there's a case in front of the Supreme Court involving a drug dealer who caused the death of a junkie, and you can identify the violence and say that's a problem. But at the other extreme, when we're talking about, again, folks who are just dealing to try to sustain their own habit or otherwise aren't involved in major drug operations, the notion that street-level buy-and-bust deal really is a violent crime and needs to be treated as severely as a homicide or as a rape is what creates these tensions and these challenges. And again, that's where I continue to agree prosecutors use their discretion well. The problem with mandatory minimums is once the prosecutors make their decision, judges have no corresponding discretion to the extent that, again, judges do their sentencing on the record and it's subject to review, whereas prosecutors don't. I'm always inclined at the margins to say it should be the judge that makes the final sentencing decision using his or her discretion, not the prosecutor.
Michael Ramos, another criticism of the system has been the conspiracy law, and that sort of gets to what Doug Berman was just talking about a little bit. The guy who's loading the bales into the boat, the bales of marijuana into the boat to make an extra $50,
right,
is caught up in the same conspiracy, and the conspiracy law makes everyone in a conspiracy liable for every act of the conspiracy. That makes the guy that's loading those bales at that fixed rate sort of as liable as the drug kingpin, you know, somewhere in a different country or perhaps who stands to profit immensely from that. What do you make of that that difference?
That's the perfect example of where district attorneys use their discretion. I will guarantee you, in my office, in the state, in the U.S. Attorney's Office in California, that person loading the bales, okay, they would determine, they would make it a non-criminal co-conspirator. They could cut a deal with that person to turn on the others. So we, as prosecutors, have all of the tools, the evidence, and the facts to use our discretion. So that person that perhaps is loading the bales, that has no priors, no serious violent felony past, we would do something so that he would not be put through or eligible for the mandatory minimum sentencing.
Do you think there should be a cutoff for prior, say, something that they did when they were 18 in high school? Should that be like they sold a bag of weed? Is that a prior, a legitimate prior, when you're talking about a 35-year-old guy who's loading the bales? Let's just go back to that.
Sure, and I think it depends on the states. I know we have cutoffs for certain priors in the state of California. I'm not sure what it is at the national level. But again, we, as prosecutors, would use that and use our discretion. This happened when he was 18. He's now 40. We would probably not file that as a prior for an enhancement. In fact, I would tell you we would not.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us all the way from California. Sure. We always appreciate that. Michael Ramos, he is a district attorney for San Bernardino County in California. He's also vice president of the National District Attorneys Association. We'll be right back, continue our conversation about mandatory minimum sentencing. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today we're talking about a move to change federal mandatory minimum sentencing laws. A new bill has been introduced that would give judges more sentencing discretion regarding those federal laws. In testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Rand Paul, one of the co-sponsors of that legislation, blamed the mandatory minimum sentencing for a huge growth in the prison population, five times as many prisoners as in 1978.
By design, mandatory sentencing laws take discretion away from judges so as to impose often harsh sentences regardless of circumstances. Since mandatory sentencing began, Americans' prison population has exploded, quadrupled, 2.4 million people in jail. America now jails a higher percentage of citizens than any other country in the world at a staggering cost of $80 billion a year.
Okay, and I'm pretty sure that that number includes jails, state prisons, and federal prisons, which is why it's a different number than what I used at the front end of the show. Joining us today by phone from Grand Rapids, Michigan, is U.S. District Court Judge Robert Holmes Bell. Judge Bell is chair of the Criminal Law Committee of the Judicial Conference of the United States. He, along with other judges, recently authored a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee in favor of a bipartisan measure, the one we just talked about, that would reform mandatory minimum sentencing, shifting more discretion to judges. Welcome to the show, Judge.
Thank you. Nice to be here with you, Ann.
In your letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee, you called the practice of mandatory minimum sentencing a waste of tax dollars that produces unjust results. First of all, where's the waste? If people break the law, they go to jail, that we have to pony up and pay for that.
Yes, the waste is, of course, because the number of mandatory minimum federal statutes has nearly doubled. It's now 195 federal statutes that carry mandatory minimums. Mandatory minimums have been with us a long time. They've been with us since the pirating days, as early as 1857, 1 month of mandatory minimum for refusing to testify before Congress. I mean, they've been around a long time. Mm-hmm. But we have interfaced with the federal judges these guideline sentences that were passed by Congress in 1984 and came into effect in 1987, where crimes by types are given numerical points and criminal records are scored. And the intersection of the numerical points assessed to the particular criminalized matter, together with aggravating, mitigating factors, are then cross-indexed for a presumptive criminal offense level. For instance, a criminal offense level of 18, a criminal record level of 4, would be a presumed sentence of 41 to 51 months. These are carefully calibrated in and recalibrated every year with input from the government, with input from the defense bar, and from the judges. There's a very detailed study that takes place. And what happens is we're attempting to determine a just sentence within the particularized individual and crime in front of us. But what happens with a mandatory sentence is it just trumps all this carefully calibrated factoring and says it's 5, it's 10, it's 25. Many times a judge may sentence within the statutory maximum to more than the mandatory because the federal guidelines might dictate it. It's on the lower sentences that the court is concerned. However, half of the mandatory sentences that the judges impose are reduced by some motion made by the government, usually for cooperation or some such other matter.
Have you always opposed mandatory minimum sentencing as a rule? I don't know how long you've been on the bench or have practiced,
yes,
but have you changed your mind over time or what?
Well, the Judicial Conference has always had an opposition to mandatory minimums, saying, Congress, you gave us sentence guidelines. We've taken them seriously. We've worked on them. We have a vigorous, robust review of them in the courts of appeals. And my own view, and I was appointed by Ronald Reagan, so please don't think I'm a screaming liberal.
You're not one of those soft liberals looking.
No, I'm not. But it seems to this court that what it comes down to in final analysis is looking at the men and women who've been given this awesome responsibility of using some discretion within the guidelines to determine what is a just sentence that protects the public, delineates the hierarchy of the seriousness of criminal offenses and provides a potential of sentence rehabilitation through the various programmatic measures both within the institution and outside the institution on supervised release.
I put it this way to a previous guest, Michael Ramos, from San Bernardino County in California, where he's a district attorney. And in most people's eyes, judges and prosecutors or district attorneys are on the same side of the same side. But you're on radically different pages when it comes to this issue. And as you pointed out, 195 federal statutes that involve mandatory minimums is a big issue. Some have framed the situation as a power struggle between prosecutors and judges. What do you make of that?
It looks like it, doesn't it? But I have great respect for the Department of Justice and the United States attorneys, those that appear in front of me almost every day. Great respect to them. They're all fine lawyers. They are making discretionary calls when they charge. Regardless of a mandatory sentence provisions, they make a discretionary charge. That's given. I think there is a feeling that they want that ability to charge and they want the ability to use that mandatory sentencing factor. I really don't think that's the purpose of mandatory sentencing. I think the purpose of mandatory sentencing has been to give fair notice to the public that certain behavior is not permitted and it has a great approbation. And we all live with mandatory sentences. If we drive 100 miles an hour and get pulled over on the freeway, we're going to get a ticket. And that ticket is going to be on a scale at whatever court you're in. It's the scale is either 100, 150, 200, whatever the amount is. That's a mandatory sentence of money. So we live with mandatory sentences in the lower end of things. But on the higher end, which is what we're talking about now, that's when I believe discretion and judicial discretion is absolutely critical for the public.
The idea of uniform sentencing was established, some believe, in the first place, because depending on where you lived, you were more or less likely to get a tougher or an easier sentence, depending on the color of your skin, depending on your ethnicity, depending on a lot of things because of the discretion that judges had at the time. Could we return to those days without the mandatory minimums?
We have them to a certain extent now. Each community has its own concerns. Each community has, for instance, a particular drug that's of great concern to the court, to the particular mm-hmm. court, to the U.S. attorney, to the public. In some places, it's crystal meth. Mm-hmm. Out in California, it's crystal meth. Here where I live, a lot of it is powder and crack cocaine. And there's quite a bit of marijuana in addition to that. So every district has a certain drug issue that's not as peculiar to the district, either geographically or some other such matter. I have a drug running couriers coming between Chicago and Detroit down I-94 that you may be familiar with, Alan. Mm-hmm. And they have a setup where they pull them over and find enormous quantities of cocaine that come from organized criminal activity. And so each one has a peculiar interest in it, but they're reviewed by the particular circuit courts that are part of the particular state's configurations. And those courts will send signals to the trial bench. No question about it.
By the way, Judge Bell said I might be familiar with that, not because I'm involved in it, but because I'm from the area. Doug Berman.
Well, I just want to highlight that Judge Bell's raising a point that largely explains why, to some people's surprise, but not to mine, we're seeing more of the Tea Party faction of the GOP supporting federal sentencing reforms. It really fits with Senator Rand Paul's and Senator Mike Lee's kind of attitude that dictates for the nation shouldn't be coming out of Washington. They should be more localized. They should be more based in states, based in local communities. And what Judge Bell's highlighting, and it's another aspect of what leads me to support federal mandatory minimum reform in particular, is different communities are going to have a localized sense of when they need to use their expensive prison resources, more or less depending on unique crime conditions, unique kinds of offenders, unique whether it's drug distribution or violent crime that's driving concerns within that community. And one of, I think, the many problems with federal mandatory minimums is it's not just one size fits all for a particular crime, but one size fits all for the entire nation. And that, among other things, creates a distorted sense of priority sometimes, even for the federal prosecutors, who necessarily are attentive to local concerns, but then have to report back to Washington and have to concern themselves with whether they're following these national federal policies. And so another aspect of what gets into some of the points that Judge Bell is highlighting is federal judges in particular are going to be attentive to local community needs in a way that doesn't require them as independent actors to report back to Washington and to their bosses about whether they're following the national script. And so it's another aspect of where, when we're talking about federal mandatory minimums in particular, it's also a story of whether a local community or folks inside the Beltway should be deciding how things get decided in local communities.
The National District Attorneys Association has asserted that mandatory minimum sentencing has played a part in the recent downturn in crime rates. We know that this has occurred just in the last 3 years or so. Judge Bell, do you agree that there's a connection, perhaps?
A connection, but not a strong one, in my view. In my view, the person's committing, you know, as I say, I take guilty pleas all the time from people for major criminal activity. And one of the questions I ask them is, didn't you know what you were doing was illegal? Yes. Well, haven't you delivered drugs 4 different previous times? Yeah, but the sentence was only 30 or 60 days. Well, it's going to be more this time. You understand that? Oh, I sure do. I sure do. So there is some within that community that's criminally inclined, there is some understanding of the fact that if I am caught, I will get a sentence. And the reputation for lenient sentencing is really a problem. And that's why the guideline sentences go into the criminal record and they hike the sentence up for someone who has had previous convictions and apparently hasn't learned their lesson. But the person who's coming in for the first or second time in their life gets that lower sentence to acknowledge the fact that they are not that familiar or they're not acquainted and or they're ignorant of what the consequences are. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Last, I earlier referred to the letter that your organization, the Judicial Conference of the United States, sent to the Senate Judiciary Committee regarding the legislation introduced by Senators Patrick Leahy and Rand Paul. And in the letter, it referred to possible, not iterations, but different like step-ups to changing the law or step-downs from the law. Can you talk about what you mean by that and how you would, you know, if the law didn't go through as is, how you think about it in an iteration, as iterations of change?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
I'd like indeterminate sentences for a number of reasons. One is, we have to do something about changing the mindsets of people when they're in prison. I visit federal prisons periodically, and I talk to the prisoners. I mean, it's all a part of a program we have. And giving good time for work learned, for courses that have been attended, and for educational achievements that have been done is an incentive to get out earlier. And with that incentive to get out earlier comes the knowledge that the supervised release officers who are going to be following them are going to report to me directly the moment something illegal or unlawful occurs. So I think a well-run system, which we're trying to do in the federal level, and we're achieving some of that despite the budget, a well-run system should be able to take care of it without the mandatory sentence, which is a disincentive. Director Samuels from the Bureau of Prisons will tell you some of the most difficult disciplinary issues in the prison arise from people who have no incentive. They're getting life. They're getting 35 years. They're getting 30 years, and they have no incentive to behave.
And those mandatory minimums, the mandatory part is that they can't be changed. They can't be let out for good behavior and that sort of thing.
Nope, that's mandatory, right? That's the downside of mandatory.
So if at least at that end of the equation, judges had more discretion, at least for early release, for good behavior and that sort of thing, that might be what you're talking about.
Oh, and the prison would have that.
And the prison too.
Would have that.
Okay.
Yes. And the U.S. attorney would have that, obviously, too. Yes.
Well, Judge Bell, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Robert Holmes Bell. He's a U.S. District Court judge and chair of the Criminal Law Committee of the Judicial Conference of the United States. And also Doug Berman, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Ann. This is an important topic. I'm glad you're covering it.
Doug Berman, he's a professor at OSU Moritz College of Law. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.